As sudden thunder pierces night, as magic wonder wild affright, rives asunder men's delight, our ghost, our corpses, and we rise to be.
Are we having a seance?
Those are just some lines from a poem by Thomas Lovell Beddoes, which is what Otho uses to have his exorcism.
To resurrect the dead?
Yes. Yeah, I couldn't find the exact line. But anyway, I'm Bailey Moore.
Last name is so official. I'm Chaney Moore.
And this is Two Sisters Present Canada, sweethearts. Yeah, that's right. You heard right. We stuttered because it's different.
Oh, Canada and Catherine O'Hara.
This is Canada's sweetheart. And our first sweetheart that we're focusing on is Catherine O'Hara. And I could not be more excited because she has been one of my favorite actors for a very, very long time.
Yep. Can confirm.
Good.
No, I love her too. She's wonderful. She can do no wrong in my eyes.
Yeah. I drew first and I drew horror. So I feel like the choice was obvious. I picked the classic horror comedy Beetlejuice.
You say that it's obvious, but I feel like there's another obvious contender.
Hold up the phone. Nightmare Before Christmas.
Correct.
Yes, you're right. You're right. But so far, we haven't done any voice acting. That doesn't mean that we won't at some point in the future. I mean, maybe even in a listener's choice here. I don't know. But I had to go with Beetlejuice.
She plays two different characters in that movie.
I know. I know. She's amazing.
She's amazing. Okay. I'm not begrudging your choice. I'm just saying there was another contender. That's all.
You just didn't feel like it was that obvious.
Exactly. Not as obvious as you are saying that it was.
All right, so Catherine O'Hara plays the red-headed 80s contemporary sculptor Delia Dietz. It's also starring Michael Keaton, Winona Ryder, Gina Davis, Alec Baldwin, Jeffrey Jones, Glenn Shaddix, and Sylvia Sidney.
Who are the last two? What characters
Glenn,
are they?
Glenn Shaddix is Otho, okay. And Sylvia Sidney is Juno the caseworker.
Okay.
First off, I kind of want to start with a little bit of trivia, which I totally meant to insert into our quick take, but completely forgot.
Well, so missed opportunities.
Yeah, well, we'll do it now. Right now. Now. The question was out of these three, which is a title not considered for Beetlejuice? Recently deceased, house ghosts, or scared sheetless?
Which one was not considered?
Which one was not considered?
Say them again.
Recently deceased, house ghosts, or scared sheetless?
House ghosts.
You are wrong.
Oh.
House ghosts was the original working title. And the other one that was considered, which was...
Scared sheetless.
Scared sheetless. And Tim Burton suggested it as a joke, but the studio took it seriously and he was horrified. We're like, no, we are not using that. But considering that, you know, there was another movie that came out, like, I don't know, the year before or something, called High Spirits, Scared Sheetless doesn't seem that far off.
So I have to admit something. When I was trying to find the movie to watch it, I had watched it a couple weeks ago with my friends, but I wasn't really paying attention when I was watching it because, you know, when it's that group environment, it's harder to pay attention to movies. So I wanted to watch it again for the podcast. And in the movie, he spells his name B-E-T-E-L-G something or other.
Beetlegeist.
Right. So that's how I tried to search for it. Because I saw it visually, and so that's what stuck with me. I could not find it. I could not spell this movie to save my life, because then I started looking for like Beetle, like B-E-A-T, and that doesn't exist either. It took me a good 10 minutes to find this movie.
Beetle, as in the Beatles, that's they spelled it incorrectly, spelling B-E-A-T as in beat, like beat the drum, Beatles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, I remember things visually, so those names stuck with me. Not actual Beetlejuice like,
well, it's funny that you bring up Beetlegeist, because I didn't write this in my notes, but that character is named after a star in the constellation Orion.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay, so I kind of wanted to start with a few facts about the film in general before we get to the star of the series.
Cool.
All right, so Beetlejuice came out in 1988 and was a critical and commercial success, grossing $73.7 million from a budget of $15 million. It won the Academy Award for Best Makeup and 3 Saturn Awards, including Best Horror Film, Best Makeup, and Best Supporting Actress for Sylvia Sidney, who played Juno the Caseworker. The film's success spawned an animated television series, video games, and a 2018 stage musical, which I figure you probably already know about.
Yes. I remember watching the show, the animated series when we were kids. I remember watching that. But yeah, the stage show, I have not seen it, but I've heard great things about it. So
I'm very curious. I kind of want to look it up on Spotify, listen to it.
Yeah.
So it was the 10th biggest grossing film of 1988. And at first I thought, 10th biggest? Like, it should have been further up there. This is a really great movie. But I looked up 1988, and 1988 had like a bunch of really great movies that came out that year, including Willow and Big and okay. Earth Girls Are Easy.
So I have tried twice to make Nicholas watch Willow. And he's fallen asleep both times. He says that it's a terrible movie. And he's like, nothing happens. Nothing happens. Everything happens to Willow. He doesn't actually do anything. And it makes me so mad. Because it's such a good movie.
Well, I mean, I think that the only reason why nothing happens is because he sleeps through it.
Willow?
No, you said that he falls asleep.
Oh, Nick sleeps through it, so nothing happens.
Yeah, I know. So nothing happens. The other little tidbit is that Beetlejuice was the first DVD sent out on Netflix in 1998. So if you remember, that's how Netflix worked at the beginning.
Netflix, it's over 10 years old.
Yeah, it started out as a mail, like a video rental service through the mail, and they sent you DVDs, and then you had to return them.
I feel old.
I mean, I only sort of knew about Netflix that way when I was in college. So that was like the early 2000s. But I didn't have the service. I didn't get it until much later when it was just streaming. Actually, no. It was streaming and DVD when I got on. But yeah. Yeah. That's irrelevant. Let's move on.
Thank you.
So out of that $15 million budget, only $1 million went to the visual effects in this movie.
Really?
Yeah. Isn't that impressive?
I mean, I guess it all depends on what you consider visual effects, because I feel like this whole movie is a visual effect. So, right.
Yeah. I think that a lot of that comes down to, like, the set designer and the people in charge of that kind of thing. And also Tim Burton's, like, his flair.
His keen eye.
Right, so that $1 million allotment to special effects is what influenced Tim Burton's decision to make the effects look as tacky and B-movie as possible. Which, let's be honest, he probably wanted to do that anyway.
Right.
Here's something interesting. I don't know how much you paid attention to the credits. I've only just started to pay better attention to credits, and I never realized that this movie wasn't Tim Burton's brainchild.
No, I did not.
Okay. It totally seems like something that he would make up. But no. It was a concept developed in script form by someone named Michael McDowell, who was inspired by the success of Poltergeist. But he wanted to flip the script and make the living people the unwanted invaders.
Interesting. Okay.
Considering that, and the fact that Tim Burton had only directed one feature film at this point, which, can you guess?
Pee-wee Herman.
Yes, Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Look at me!
Yeah. Mm. Is it surprising if I tell you that someone else was originally asked to direct this film?
I'm trying to think of who.
So think about it being inspired by Poltergeist.
Steven Spielberg.
No, but that was a good guess. Although, he didn't direct that movie. He produced it.
Oh. Well, at least it's in the ballpark. Yeah. No, I don't know.
Wes Craven.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so the original script was much, much darker. In the original script, the death of the Maitlands was depicted graphically. There was a second, younger Dietz child who was the only one to be able to see the Maitlands, and Beetlejuice, while disguised as a rabid squirrel, attacks and mutilates her before revealing himself as a winged demon who is summoned only by being exhumed and isn't controlled or sent away by saying his name three times.
That's a lot.
Yeah, right?
That's a lot. You know, I like that the... What are their names? Their names? The Maitlands?
The Maitlands.
I like that their death was kind of vague, because when they walk in the house, you're like, oh, they lived. They survived. And then,
right.
And then it's kind of a reveal that they're actually dead.
Right, because we're on the journey with them.
Right.
Like, we're supposed to be more aligned with them than with the Dietzes.
Also, I'm mad because she probably, I mean... Poor dog. But she probably would have hit that dog and they would have lived to see another day if Alec Baldwin didn't take the wheel from her and steer her off of the bridge.
Well, when I was a kid, I always got mad at that dog because they swerved to not hit the dog. And then the dog is the only thing keeping them balanced. Uh-huh. And the dog looks at them. He's like, whatevs. And just like hops off the plank. And I was like, come on, dog, recognize.
Yeah, he's rude.
Recognize that they did that thing for you.
Yeah, you would have been roadkill. Rude.
Rude. So eventually, Tim Burton was given the script and he liked it, but ultimately had created differences with Michael McDowell and brought in someone else named Warren Scarron to rework the screenplay. Still, a lot of what Warren Scarron contributed did not make it to the screen. One of the most notable was that there are multiple limbos that Barbara and Adam encounter every time they leave the house. And one was a clock world of enormous gears. And another was the sandworm world, which makes a whole lot more sense now. Because I always wondered, like, what the sandworm world actually was.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it, but I didn't understand what it was supposed to be.
It's a different limbo.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a different limbo.
Yeah.
And the other thing that he contributed that kind of got changed a little bit was that he designated that there should be a musical motif to occur every time the Maitlands did their ghostly thing. And his idea was that it be R&B songs, but instead they went with Harry Belafonte, which I think was the correct choice.
I agree. It makes me curious, though, now to see the musical, because... Now they could actually incorporate that idea because it is a musical.
Yeah, you're right.
So just curious about that.
Right. And well, and on that same vein, the last song with Lydia dancing, because she aces the
shake,
math test.
Shake, Sonora.
That one. Right.
Mm-hmm.
They were supposed to do When a Man Loves a Woman.
Weird.
I know.
That's weird. I don't even know what to say. That's a choice.
Yeah, it is. That's exactly what it is. It's a choice, and it was the wrong one, because obviously the right one was Harry Belafonte.
What was the thought process behind that? Like, I understand what is their name? Maitlands?
Maitlands.
I understand if it was the Maitlands, because they love each other, but to have Lydia dancing to it is... weird.
Yeah, I don't know. All right, so now we get to play our game.
Yay!
And I have quite a bit for you.
Great.
So, according to Tim Burton, it took a lot of time to convince cast members to sign on to the project, as they thought the script was too weird. Gina Davis was the only cast member who would commit to the project at first.
I love Gina Davis, so...
I know.
Way to go, you.
It seems like she was just kind of game for a lot of weird and interesting projects, because this was also the same year as Earth Girls Are Easy.
She just seems like a cool person.
Yeah. Michael Keaton, Winona Ryder, Catherine O'Hara, and Sylvia Sidney all said no at least once.
Okay.
So let's start with the titular character, Beetlejuice.
All right.
So the role is of course played by Michael Keaton. Mm-hmm. This is one of his favorite films that he worked on, and he ad-libs 90% of his lines in this.
Really? Okay, yes. So while we were watching it as a group, I was like, he must be exhausted. The amount of energy that he's exuding, I mean, he needs a nap.
Yeah, I mean, no wonder it's his favorite role. He looks like he's having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But yes, a lot of energy. So, as I mentioned, he did not originally want the role because he didn't understand it. And he was not alone there. A lot of people thought the script was a waste of time. But Michael Keaton came around after watching Pee-wee's Big Adventure and meeting Tim Burton.
Mm.
All right, so first round.
Okay.
Who do you think was offered this role?
Of Beetlejuice.
Yes.
Jack Nicholson.
Yep.
I'm trying to think of more eccentric actors. Nick Cage.
No.
I don't know. That's it.
Okay. So originally Tim Burton wanted Sammy Davis Jr. to play the role, but the producer just didn't like that.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. There was also Dustin Hoffman.
Okay.
Robin Williams.
Ah, uh-huh.
Dudley Moore.
Okay.
Christopher Lloyd.
Mm. Christopher Walken?
No.
Ugh.
Jim Carrey, Tim Curry, like you said, Jack Nicholson, Bill Murray.
Okay.
Robert De Niro.
Mm-hmm.
And John Cleese.
Mm.
Honestly, I feel like the best out of that would have been Robert De Niro.
Maybe. I don't know. Because I feel like the comedians that they picked, mm-hmm. or the comedic actors that they picked, have a very stylized, or not stylized, they have a very specific type of comedy that they play mm-hmm. to, where this is, it's different. I feel like Jack Nicholson is my top choice outside of Michael Keaton, because I feel like he can play that dark comedy.
Okay. One of the stranger choices, I think. At one point, Tim Burton considered Arnold Schwarzenegger for the role of Beetlejuice.
If only you could see my face. Yeah. Well, you can, Bailey, but choices are being made here. What was the other one that I was like, it's a choice? Oh, When a Man Loves a Woman.
Yeah.
Oof. Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay, Arnold.
Yeah, the producers didn't like that idea, but Tim Burton approached him anyway, and Arnold Schwarzenegger turned it down because he was busy shooting The Running Man.
Ah, okay. I mean, I will say Arnold did his own fair share amount of weird movies.
Yes.
I can understand why Tim Burton would be like, okay, this guy would be game.
But they're more action.
They are more action. It would have been, my name is Beetlejuice. I can't do his accent.
It's like,
get to the chopper.
My name is Beetlejuice. My name is Beetlejuice. I can't do it. Don't do it. Don't put it in there. My terrible accent.
Okay. It's going in.
No. All right. Lydia.
Yes, Lydia. Okay.
Okay, so that's performed by Winona Ryder.
Mm-hmm.
Guesses?
I'm trying to think of who was her age. Molly Ringwald.
Yes.
The girl that was in Dirty Dancing. Jennifer Grey.
No.
Sarah Jessica Parker.
Yes.
Shannon Doherty.
No. Shannon Doherty is a good guess because there's someone else that was in Charmed.
Melissa Milano.
Alyssa Milano.
Alyssa. Sorry, I know a girl who has a very similar name, so I always get them confused.
So the other ones that you haven't guessed, Juliette Lewis,
mm-hmm. okay.
Lori Loughlin, mm. Diane Lane, Brooke Shields,
mm-hmm.
Heather Langenkamp, Jennifer Connelly. And Alyssa Milano actually was the other person that was between her and Winona Ryder.
I can see her playing this part.
Yes, absolutely.
Especially after seeing Canterville Ghost.
Yeah, and you know what? Like, she was a very, very gifted from a young age.
Yes, she was.
Okay. So, all right, Barbara.
Barbara.
Played by Gina Davis.
I don't know, just list those.
Okay. So the first choice was Christy Alley.
Oh, I could see that. I could see that.
But she couldn't get away from Cheers to take the role.
Okay.
So we also have Linda Blair. Linda Hamilton. Laura Dern. Goldie Hawn. And Sigourney Weaver.
You know, I would not have been mad at any of those choices, really.
I know, right?
Yeah. I think they all would have been great.
I agree.
I mean, I love Gina Davis, but I think that they all, none of those would be in a bad choice.
No, absolutely not. So Adam is played by Alec Baldwin, but apparently Alec Baldwin dislikes this film and is very unhappy with his performance in it, which funny. I think it's a shame. I think he's super cute. Yes, yeah,
he's charming. Were they also considering Jim Carrey for this too?
No, I only have one person that I could find that was considered for this role, and I feel like he has a very similar vibe to Alec Baldwin.
His brother.
No. no, but think about another movie that takes place in a big haunted house.
A big haunted house.
Can I keep you?
Casper. Oh, Bill Pullman?
Bill Pullman.
Oh, if it was Bill Pullman and Gina Davis, then it would have been like, it would have been like what happened after A League of Their Own. She finished her baseball career and then they moved into this farmhouse and then they died and got to live, died happily ever after.
Oh my gosh, it's so true. Wow. Amazing, Jamie.
Thank you.
The last character that I have before we get to Delia is Otho, who's played by Glenn Shaddix. Any guesses? You want me to just jump right in?
Jump right in.
John Candy.
Uh-huh.
John Goodman.
Uh-huh.
Bob Hoskins.
Uh-huh.
And Wayne Knight.
Who's Wayne Knight?
You didn't say the magic word.
So they were looking for a specific physical type for Otho.
Yes. Obviously. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so Catherine O'Hara, who plays Delia. She was not the first person cast as Delia.
Okay.
Angelica Houston was originally meant to be Delia.
Okay. I mean, when did Witches come out? Was Witches before this or after?
It was after.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like, okay, so she was ill and couldn't come for the filming. But, you know, she got her spooky movies. You know, she was in The Witches. She was in The Addams Family. Mm-hmm. So I know she could have done it, but what a treat that we got Catherine O'Hara, because this was meant to be her role.
It was. It absolutely was.
She's incredible in this.
Yes.
I feel like she's often stealing the scenes a little bit.
But is that her fault?
No.
You can't. There are some people, when they steal a scene, it's intentional and you're like, okay, don't be a scene stealer. And then there are some people who are just so magnetic and brilliant that they do it automatically without any intent. And it just, it is what it is.
And that's exactly what's going on here. It's just like every time she's on screen, it's like, what are you going to do, Delia?
It's about her. It just is.
Well, I mean, and that's what the character is, too. Like, she's constantly getting in the way because she needs, like, attention.
Mm-hmm.
So it's amazing that translated so well through the film.
You say she needs attention. Maybe I see a lot of myself in Delia. Not that I need attention, but I always have to be creating something, or my mind is always trying to create something. And the whole part when she says, you will let me gut this house and make it my own, or I will go insane and I will take you with me. I literally had that conversation with Nicholas.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this already, how our perception of this character has changed over the years, and I do want to get into that. But I kind of want to go into that when we get to the walkthrough.
Okay, cool.
So I found a couple of interviews about her experience with Beetlejuice. One from back in the day, a 1988 article from the Toronto Star. And she says that she didn't understand the script when she first got it. And she was scared of the character Beetlejuice because she imagined him to be a lecherous old creep. But then she learned that Michael Keaton was attached and it changed everything for her. Mm. Now she describes, this is how she describes how she came up with her character. Basically, I just thought of myself on my worst day. Initially, I thought she was going to be this one-dimensional witch. I mean, she is the villain and everything. But instead of making her just mean, which is how I first read it, she just became someone that gets in everybody's way because she's so insecurely self-obsessed. Mm-hmm. And this is one of her experiences on set. The worst was getting French kissed by a snake, a fake snake. But the scene was cut, so I guess it didn't work. There was one scene where they wound 8 feet of snake body around my legs and then pulled so that when they ran it backwards, it looked like it was attacking me. Except the prop guy pulled too hard and I shot 6 feet into the air. I didn't feel hurt, but I looked around and saw everyone looking at me as if I were dead. So I started to cry because maybe I was dead. And this is an interview from The New Yorker by Rachel Syme about her audition for Beetlejuice, which I wanted to include because I feel like you might have some things to say about it based on your own experience of just loving the audition process.
Oh, yeah. It's what's not to love about the audition process. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Okay. She said, I'd been asked to audition for Beetlejuice. I had all these calls with David Geffen, who was a producer. I didn't know him at the time, out of ignorance. I'm like, who is this guy? He keeps bugging me. He kept calling me and saying, this is a part for you. You should be doing this. He kept calling. Then they said they wanted me to meet this guy, Tim Burton. I didn't know Tim Burton. Then finally I was depressed at home and I had nothing going. And I said, okay, I'll go audition. I'll go meet him. I flew to LA from Toronto and I rented a car. The address was in Burbank. I drove for hours. I thought, what kind of director is this far from show business? I was so late. I got lost. There was no cell phone. I had to pull over somewhere and find a phone booth and phone my agent. I finally, 2 hours late, got back to Burbank. There was a note on the door from Tim Burton. It said, I'm sorry, I waited as long as I could. I got back home to Toronto. A few weeks later, they offered me the part. It's a good trick. If you're bad at auditioning, just don't go.
I mean, if your body of work speaks for itself, that's great. I think that this is one of those exceptions to the rule. A lot of times, if you're late, bye.
Right.
So the fact that she got a part and she wasn't even seen, that's incredible.
I know, right? And she hadn't been in too many films at this point. There were a couple. I watched a movie with her in it, which she's really, really young. I guess it's earlier in the 80s, called After Hours. And I had never heard of it before. I ended up really loving it. It's so bizarre. Anyway, when asked in this interview if she's bad at auditioning, she says, I always was, yeah. When you're on the job, it's so collaborative. It's about everyone. When you're auditioning, it's only you. So it's not related to what the job will be, really. I remember auditioning for some movie to be Robert De Niro's wife in something. You're reading for three people sitting in chairs behind a desk. They were nice enough. They chatted and then let's do the scene. It's one of my worst memories, how cheesy I was. I was in a chair, but the scene took place in a bed. I tried to lie down in the chair and look like I was in bed to read. That's typical of most of my auditions.
Sounds about right. It's because film is so, you can't hide anything. You can't pretend in film. Like, it is what it is, right? Like, if you're in bed, you can't be in a chair. The camera right. will tell you you're in a chair. So I get it. I would try to make it as realistic as possible. And I would probably have ended up on the floor, honestly. You want me in a bed? Okay, well, I'm laying down on the bed floor. Auditioning is weird. It makes you feel all sorts of uncomfortable.
Right. And I think she makes a good point saying it's very far removed from what the job actually is.
Yes.
So it's really not a very good representation of what you can bring to the project. I've never been someone that is judging people auditioning like that, but I feel like there probably is an element of like the way they look, the way they comport themselves, and whether like their energy is what they feel fits the role.
Auditioning is just awkward. There's no way around it. Most of the time, you still have a paper in your hand and are reading from the paper. You have to have a sense of departure from reality. What is it called? Suspension of disbelief. There it is.
Suspension of disbelief.
Yeah. You have to have a certain amount of suspension of disbelief while watching auditions.
Mm-hmm.
But it does not feel any, it does not feel any less awkward for the actor.
Absolutely. So in addition to all of this, Catherine O'Hara met her future husband on set, Beau Welch.
Nice.
The production designer for Beetlejuice.
Cool.
And he asked her out after Tim Burton suggested it to him. He said he didn't even know he was allowed to talk to the actors.
Aww. So he was admiring her from afar. And Tim,
yeah, I guess so.
Tim saw that and he was like, hey, you can go talk to her. Go chat her up.
That's what I like to imagine anyway. It's cute. Hey, why did you pause it?
Potty break.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Don't go too far. We'll be right back. Enjoying Two Sisters Present America's Sweethearts? Feel free to leave us a review.
Tell us what you love.
And if you must, tell us what you don't love.
I don't love mayonnaise.
I mean about the podcast.
Right.
Contact us through Twitter, Instagram, or email.
Find our handles on our website, www.twosisterspresent.com.
You can also join our Patreon with exclusive content, merch, and access to picking your own movie or artist for us to cover.
What? You can pick the next America Sweetheart?
Sure can. Find out all the info at www.patreon.com/twosisterspresent.
Thank you and goodbye.
Later. All right, I'm back. I'm ready. Let's go.
Before we push play, there's one more thing we need to say.
Oh, enlighten me.
We need to give a shout out to two very special people who have helped make this podcast possible.
Oh, I know. Mm-hmm.
Drum roll, if you please. Our logo designer, Angela Panina, and the music from Colin Moore.
Oh, Angela is also an amazing baker, by the way, if you didn't know that, Bailey. Mm-mm. She has made me some gluten-free churro cupcakes to die for.
Mm.
And if anybody wants to discover just how heavenly these churro cupcakes are,
nice.
You can find Angela at Angelic Confections on Facebook or at Angelic Confections HTX on Instagram. So that's Angelic Confections, Houston, Texas, but HTX.
Churro cupcakes sound amazing.
Oh, Bailey, you don't even know. I could live in that icing. It's so good.
You can also find more of Cullen's music on Spotify. He recently released his first plaid tuxedo album, Soaring Through the Wind.
I listen to it almost daily. Hashtag no regrets.
Anyway, you guys are awesome. Ready?
Oh, super ready.
3, 2, 1, go. So, let's talk movie.
Movie!
So we open with, I feel like one of the best openers in any film I've ever seen. It's so exciting. So you have the variation on the Banana Boat song and then Danny Elfman's awesome scoring as it's gliding over town in a helicopter shot. It's just so exciting. Mm-hmm. It really sets the tone for the whole movie.
Mm-hmm. It's fun, but then creepy.
Yeah, exactly. And so we meet the Maitlands, and they've got this big house. They're on vacation, but it's a vacation in home, in their home.
Okay. All right. Can we talk about, is she actually related to him? What, their neighbor?
Oh, Jane, the awful real estate agent?
Can we talk about Jane?
Yes, let's talk about Jane. I was hoping we would talk about Jane.
Okay, Miss Busybody. She, How dare you be like, this house is too big for two people. It's really for a family. Where do you get the audacity, ma'am?
Yeah, it's so rude. And I've always been really confused by her. Like, is she just a real estate agent? Is she one of their sisters or cousin? Because at one point she says they were family, but right. Is that just a small town thing to say? I don't know. She doesn't really behave very much like either.
Right. No, it's completely unacceptable. And they are way nicer to her than I would have been.
Yeah.
Do not come up in my house telling me that I need to sell my property, that it's too big for me, that I should have a family if I'm going to be here. Goodbye.
And the fact that she's sending photographs out as if it's already for sale.
Right.
And I assume that the bite that she gets is the Dietz's.
Yeah, because she says it's from New York and they're from New York.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Nope.
No.
They were way nicer. I would have been not very kind to that lady.
No. I mean, I guess, like, if she was family, the fact that they were a little bit nicer kind of makes sense because you tolerate, like, family you don't get along with. at least that's what I've heard. I get along so well with all of my family.
Nice. Nice, yeah. Cover up there. Okay, moving on.
Okay, so they're on this vacation at home, maybe to, like, try to have a baby, and Adam is
right, building. That's another thing with what's-her-face. Jane?
Yeah.
Jane. Yeah, just because they don't have kids, they're a young couple, they may have plans to have kids. It's none of your business.
Right, I mean, and she just got off of her successful career as a baseball player.
Now's the prime family making time.
Yeah, he just got back from the war. Give them some time.
I like this mashup of A League of Their Own and Beetlejuice.
Yeah. So he's building a model version of the entire town, and he needs some supplies. So he goes to his general store that he has, or hardware store in town. And as they're driving back, as you said, they try to miss a dog and they drive off the bridge. And so their car that they're using is a 240 series Volvo that at the time was considered the safest car in the world. And purportedly no one had ever been killed in one of those Volvos. And the fact that Adam and Barbara die in one is like a huge inside joke for Volvo owners.
That's really funny.
Isn't that great?
Extenuating circumstances.
Yeah. And when they go back, they're soaking wet, but they're trying to figure things out. And that's when we get the first spooky stuff.
Right.
Which I love. I love them figuring it out. It's some of my favorite parts of the whole movie.
Mm-hmm. Fingers on fire, no reflection, a book for the recently deceased is now in their house.
Handbook for the recently diseased. You know, I have to say that line always cracks me up because the way that diseased is spelled versus the way that deceased is spelled, it's not really believable that someone is going to look at that and misread it.
Yes, yes it is, Bailey. Yes, it is. My friend sent me let me see if I can find it. A picture of a wine bottle. Granted, I had only been getting about 4 hours of sleep for like 3 nights in a row, but the wine bottle says Costa di Bussia, Barbara d'Alba. What my brain read was Costa Rica de Bussi, Barbara de Labia. So, disease and deceased, definitely in the realm of things that I would mess up.
I mean, that's like, okay, all right, point taken. Still, it makes me laugh because he says it so confidently and so, like, flippantly. He's like, I don't know why you're showing me this. And she's like, read it again. But I did want to point out that cool scene where they're looking in the mirror and they have no reflections and the little horses trotting. Uh-huh. The way that they did with that is they actually turned the fireplace around mm-hmm. in the set. It took the mirror out. So they're actually looking into the set.
Right.
You knew that.
Makes sense. No, it just makes sense.
Okay. Well, I thought that was pretty cool. You know, movie magic.
Yeah.
You know, not relying on just CGI to make the effects happen.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. All right. They're trying to read through the handbook, and it reads like...
a stereo manual.
And they say that the living won't usually see the dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's this line that made me try to see ghosts throughout all of my childhood.
Makes sense. Yeah. You want to be the one.
Yeah. All right. So I don't know why I wrote this down. I just wrote Barbara floating above the bed, I think because I thought it was cool. It's unclear whether, like, the blanket being pulled off of her makes her fall or her waking up makes her fall. But it's like Looney Tune kind of rules there.
Yeah.
And so enter the Dietzes, meaning enter Delia because, you know.
She comes in and immediately takes over. I love when the guy is carrying her sculpture, she's like, that's my sculpture. And I don't mean that I bought it. I made it. That's my sculpture. So be careful with it. And then he literally throws it on the table.
Yes.
No one gives her respect.
It's so rude. It's like, I know that she's like really hyper and maybe she could be a little nicer, but still, like, that's his job.
Right.
And he just dumps it on the table. And like, I think that she's really stressed. I think mm-hmm. she's super stressed because I get the impression that she really, like, moving there was not really her idea and not really something that she wanted to do. And correct. I think that her husband decided, and so they had to move.
No, imagine you're taken away from all of your friends. You're put in a location that does not give you any sort of inspiration, why can't I say this word?
Creatively.
Thank you. Creatively. Yeah.
It's okay. Cinematographical.
Cinematographical choices. Doesn't give you any inspiration. Creatively. God. And you're kind of out of touch with your network, you know? So
mm-hmm.
I can completely understand her being stressed. And when you are so in tuned with your surroundings and your own aesthetic, when we first moved into this house, the walls were supposed to be a specific color gray. They mm-hmm. were painted the wrong color gray. I walked in and I was like, I can't live in this house. I can't. It makes me want to just scream. Mm-hmm. It's a very visceral thing. So, like I said, I see a lot of myself in Delia. So yeah. I get why she is like on edge, why she says she's going to go insane if she can't fix this house to her liking. Because if you're put in something that is not you and you're supposed to thrive there.
Right. Well, it's like when I was younger watching this, I saw her as not nice,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I have a lot more empathy for her watching it as an adult because she's just like, you know, like the scene that you mentioned before where Charles fusses at Delia for, you know, already making plans to change the house and they haven't even spent 20 minutes there. She says, you got to let me do this or I'm going to go insane and I'm going to take you with me. And he's like, okay, just leave this room alone. And then he kind of shakes his fist or like when she leaves. And I'm like, all she's doing is being assertive and like expressing the things that she needs in order to cope with what's happening when she didn't seem like she had a lot of control over like the fact that she's there in the first place.
Right. She's just trying to take a little bit of that control back and make it a suitable situation for her as well as everybody else.
Right. Something that feels like home for her.
Right.
Right.
I don't think saying you wanted to move out to the country, we did that. Now let me do something that makes me comfortable. I think right. that's a fair compromise.
Absolutely. And I kind of want to know like how the two of them got together and made a successful relationship because they are so different. I mean, Mr. Dietz's idea of relaxing is hanging out in his office that is full of other people's stuff. Because like, you know, the wedding picture is still of the Maitlands is still in the office. And he's sitting back in the chair, peering through the window through binoculars and assessing the quality of the parking at the nearby church. They're so different.
It feels very me and Nick. He's so literal and analytical, and I'm very much the opposite of that, but we work. We're both very supportive of each other, and I think that you see that in this movie too, that even though they're so different, they still support each other.
Yeah. I just want to say, at that the first dinner that they have in the house, they're eating takeout, that I love the black glove hairpiece that Delia has in her hair.
It's her other glove. She's only wearing one.
She's only wearing one. Oh my gosh. I didn't realize that. I did recognize that she only had one glove on.
I just love her. I would have that hairstyle, that wardrobe. I would have a lot of her sculptures.
Uh-huh.
The fact that her manager is like, you're a flake, and isn't interested in any of her pieces. I'm like, they're so cool.
I agree. I feel like they're supposed to be, what's the word I'm looking for? Too abstract, just really strange and unknowable. But I don't feel that way at all. I think all of those art pieces are really cool.
Well, especially when they're used in different ways. Like, they're used for chairs. I mean, not intentionally. It's when they're being, you know, wrapped up and imprisoned by them. But seeing how the art also functions as other things is really cool.
Yeah, it's funny. It's a funny bit of foreshadowing when they're moving the sculptures into the house and she gets pinned to the wall. She's like, my art is dangerous. Do you think I want to die like this? And then that's the one that has her later on.
Yep.
Oh, she's so good.
Yep. I know that we're kind of just talking about Catherine right now, but I want to say one more thing. I really love how comfortable she is with her physicality and being physical with other people. Like, there's one part where she licks her husband's nose as like a thanks for letting me do my thing. Yes. And it's very something that you would see in a long-term relationship. And that's not something you typically see in film because people don't create those nuances because they
haven't had enough time to develop a...
They don't even know each other most of the time.
Right.
They just have to start working together. And I love how comfortable she is with that. And I'm sure that it was something that was rehearsed and practiced, but I love it. She's just fearless.
I kind of feel like the cast in general has a pretty good chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Amongst all of them, especially everyone in relation to Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
But at that dinner scene, we also get Lydia's infamous line. My whole life is a dark room. One big dark room. And I think that gives us like a really good idea of her character, which is like the affectation of dark teenager.
Also, well, the line when she first meets Barb and Adam, when she said, I read the handbook and it said that most people don't see the strange and unusual, and I myself am strange and unusual.
Yes.
Yeah.
She seems very melodramatic, and I find that really funny.
When she's writing her suicide letter and she keeps scratching things out to create a more poetic word or phrase.
Yeah. So I think this is about when we get the commercial with Beetlejuice, and that's the first time we see him. And I don't know how closely you paid attention to like what he was saying, which I'm sure he improvised the majority of that commercial. Mm-hmm. But at the end, he's singing. And he sings, I'll eat anything you want me to eat. I'll swallow anything you want me to swallow. So come on down. I'll chew on a dog. I mean, he really is having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
All right, so they can't seem to be ghosts. You know, they can't figure it out. So they look in the handbook and it says that if they need help, they just draw a door on the wall and knock three times. So they visit Juno, the caseworker, the first time.
Which, okay, I don't remember this as a kid, but watching this as an adult. So Juno has her throat slit. There's mm-hmm. also the guy that is hanging by the noose that is passing papers out.
Yes.
And later at dinner, Otho says that anyone who commits suicide becomes a civil servant in the afterworld.
Mm-hmm.
I just never made that connection.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it leads me to wonder if Lydia actually committed suicide to be with the Maitlands, would she then just be working as a civil servant and not actually be with the Maitlands?
Oh, I think so. Which is why Beetlejuice, like when she says, I want to be on the other side, and he's like, why? He doesn't think it's all that great. He becomes a bioexorcist so that he can interact more with the living.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they come back, and even though like Juno tells them not to mess with Beetlejuice because he's bad news, they don't know what to do, so they summon him anyway.
Well, she didn't give them any options.
No.
Like, Adam was like, okay, well, if you won't let us call him, what do we do when we need to reach you again? And she just disappears.
And it seems like the people, the living people, did a better job of reading the handbook than they did.
Well, okay, there's a few times when Beetlejuice first sees their picture in the paper, he says that they look stupid. And uh-huh. they prove that a few times in the movie, where they're just not the smartest of people. And including when they go see Juno the second time and uh-huh. they show her their scary faces, both of those looks uh-huh. are things that I think Delia would create. So,
right.
They're not really playing into their strengths. They're playing into what Delia likes.
Right. She just makes sculptures out of them.
Right. So I'm like, you're not using your brains.
Yeah, I know. They summon Beetlejuice for the first time. And they go into the model and they have to dig him up. And they dig up a bunch of cardboard, which I just love.
That drove me crazy because there are clear panels that they could pick up.
Yeah.
That was another thing that I'm like, y'all are not very smart. Y'all are working harder, not smarter.
Yeah, I know. You're right. Like, it does bother me too, but I think it's cute. I was trying to figure out a way to insert this story, and this is the place to do it. I don't know if you were there or not, but when I was little, I had a friend named Crystal, and she had two twin brothers,
mm-hmm.
and we would go over to their house sometimes, and I guess it's inspired by this movie, I convinced everyone to dig a giant hole in her backyard so that we could find Beetlejuice. And we dug a giant hole.
I bet her parents were pissed.
Oh, they were so angry. I don't remember getting in trouble for it, but I'm sure they did.
And you were the one that started it.
It was totally my idea.
You're a troublemaker.
I loved Beetlejuice. I wanted to be his friend so badly because of the cartoon.
Okay, because watching this now.
Yeah.
No, he's creepy. A major pervert. And yes. Not someone you would want to be friends with.
But he's not that way in the cartoon. He and Lydia are best friends.
I remember watching the cartoon, but I don't remember much about the plot.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's cute. Also in this scene, something else I wanted to bring up. Beetlejuice kicks over a tree.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, nice effing model, honk
mm-hmm.
honk.
Mm-hmm.
So this movie, along with Spaceballs, Big, and Caddyshack 2... stand out as a PG movie containing the F word. Mm. And I bring this up because I've had several conversations with our mom about this. Hi, mom.
Hello.
We somehow saw this movie in someone else's house when we were little, and we were thereafter not allowed to watch it. And she was convinced and still is convinced this movie is quite generously peppered with curse words. And I cannot convince her otherwise. And I think it is because of the fact that the F word in a PG movie was just so shocking. And probably it upset a lot of parents who took their kids to see it.
Well, there's also a lot of innuendo. And yes. It goes straight over kids' heads. But as an adult, you're like, this movie is filled with a lot of sexual content and perversion and... than the F word. So I can see that perspective, but to a kid, all that goes straight over the head.
Right. I will point out, though, that the F word is only in there once, and I don't think that there's a lot of other curse words in it. But this is the interesting thing about it. It was never intended to be there.
Well, if he is ad-libbing most of yes. his lines.
Yeah, so apparently... Michael Keaton, one of the shots, He kicked the tree and he wasn't expecting it to fall over. So when he's saying that, he's actually razzing the set designer. But Tim Burton liked it so much that he kept it.
That's so good.
I know, right?
So it wasn't acting. It was just him making fun of... That's really good.
Well, I think he was still in character.
Right, but... right. But it was not...
Yeah.
That's so good.
The one thing that I think we definitely should cover, or we would be doing a disservice to this movie, is to talk about the Deo dinner party.
Deo! Deo!
It is... Apparently, it's just one of the most fun scenes. And apparently Tim Burton feared that it wouldn't go over well. He thought it wasn't very funny. But it ended up being one of the things that audiences remember the most.
Right.
And also, originally they were going to use a song by the Ink Spots, but Jeffrey Jones and Catherine O'Hara suggested the music be Calypso.
I think it was a great choice.
Mm-hmm.
And it leads to one of the funniest lines to me. Later, when Delia and Charles are sitting on the deck, which I love what they did with that deck, having that one wall with the picture frame window.
Yeah, it's so good.
So good. But he says, I really don't think that this house is good for Lydia. Ghosts, hauntings. And Delia goes, shrimp.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
I just have to say that Catherine O'Hara sets the tone for this scene, which since she's the first one that gets possessed, and she does such a good job of going back and forth between getting really into the spell and then looking like she's frightened, like you know, that there's a puppet master controlling all of her movements. It's so good. And then everybody else follows suit and does a great job as well. But like,
I love the moment when her hands go over her head and her hips start to move. She's like, I didn't know my hips could do this.
I know. It's so good. She is my favorite part in this scene. And the other thing that I really love in this scene is Jeffrey Jones doing the tarantula.
Yeah. Black tarantula.
Yes. Yeah.
What happens? I feel like I want to go back and watch, but what happens to Lydia? She was sitting at the table, wasn't she? And then all of a sudden she's gone. There's only six place settings. And so I don't know what happened to her.
That's a good question. I'd have to go back and look as well.
Well, we have 48 hours and then we have to re-rent it.
Yeah. And I guess like the only other interesting thing that I'd like to insert really quickly is that when they go to Juno's office the second time, there's a window behind them that has skeletons and other things in a movie theater looking in through the window. And so the idea was when it was in the theaters, it was like the audience in the theater and the skeleton audience in the window were looking out at each other, and that they could see the audience in the theater at the same
How
time.
How funny. I didn't catch that. I'll have to go back and watch that too. But in that scene, I also love how the football players say the same line that the guy, I cannot remember their name. Maitlands. They say the same line that the Maitlands say, which is, I don't think we survived the crash. So it makes me wonder if you die in a crash, do you just not remember? If you die any other way, will you remember? Is it just specific to crashes?
I feel like it's probably that most people don't remember their death because it's traumatic.
Coach, I don't think we survived the crash. But the coach actually did survive. It was just the players. And then they come back and dance with Lydia at the end.
Yeah, I love that they're there at the end.
Yeah.
Also, Lydia trying to, that she's absolutely terrible at charades. Mm-hmm. Or I don't know if it'd be Pictionary, but she's trying to figure out the name Beetlejuice. And it's like, breakfast, orange, drink. Beetle breakfast, beetle orange.
It's obviously juice.
Yeah, it's obviously juice.
When you're pouring orange juice into a cup and you say, what is this? Who just says, oh, it's orange?
Yeah, I know. Orange? Orange. I can't get beyond orange.
Liquid.
Orange peel. Orange rind. Orange pulp. Orange. It's like the same as the fact that they could just pull up the cardboard rather than dig through it.
Not the sharpest tool in the shed. Not right. The brightest color in the box.
Yeah.
Not the, what is the one with the light bulb? Not the brightest bulb in the lamp?
I don't know. On the ceiling. And the string of Christmas lights.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, speaking of Christmas lights, Stranger Things, Winona Ryder.
Yep. Very good.
Thanks. I just wanted to throw that connection in. It's a fun movie. Catherine O'Hara is just such a joy to watch. And yeah, just great. Just great.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I feel like this was a really strong start, a really strong performance.
Yes. I'm glad we started with this one.
So just some like closing thoughts on the movie. After how successful the movie was, there were plans for a sequel. Mm. Working title, Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian.
Oh, no.
And Tim Burton thought it would be funny to combine surfer culture with German expressionism.
What?
Yeah. The script was commissioned. Michael Keaton and Winona Ryder were signed on, but Tim Burton got distracted by Batman and Batman Returns, and Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian was lost in production hell. Probably still waiting on that number.
Are we sad about this?
I'm a little sad. I kind of would like to know what it would have been like.
The title gives me pause.
It does. It does. It does. Absolutely.
But that also goes to show, you know, a title means so much.
Yeah, not scared sheetless.
Because if you have a poor title, people may not watch it, even if it's a great movie.
For sure. Like, Minimum Speed.
Precisely.
Yeah. However, even though Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian is lost forever, there is currently a new sequel that is in the process of being worked on, and it's actually set the amount of years after the original. So it's like a sequel that takes place 20 some odd years later. It's being written by the author of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, Seth Graham Smith, to be released in 2021.
What? So, sorry, there's a sequel of Beetlejuice that's being produced by the same guy that did Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Yes?
Yes, the author of the book.
I'm stoked.
Right?
Color me stoked. That's my surfer.
Surfer German expressionism.
Color me. I can't do Arnold. We already discovered this.
Beetlejuice.
Get to the chopper. Color me stoked. I can't.
Color me stoked.
I always have to do get to the chopper first for me to get in any sort of realm of Arnold.
Amazing. So what are we doing next?
Next, we are doing the comedy A Mighty Wind.
Yes!
I know it's one of your all-time favorites, as well as our father's. I've actually never seen it, so I'm very excited to cover it.
I am so excited for you.
Yes, I'm excited.
All right.
This was a fun first dip into the Catherine O'Hara filmography.
Absolutely.
Did I say that correctly?
No other way.
Filmography.
Yes. I think it sounded okay.
Great.
Well, until next time, this has been Two Sisters Presents
Canada's Sweethearts.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.